So my sister is a marine biologist, and in 2002, she took this job, like an internship program in the South Indian city of Pondicherry, where she would be building composting toilets on the compound of a cult, a religious movement that was started in the 1960s called Oroville. And Oroville has always been one of my favorite places to visit in India. It is this like utopian community. It's planned out so perfectly in these concentric circles that go out several layers. And in the center of all those circles is an enormous golden globe where you meditate inside of. Actually, they don't call it meditation. They call it concentration. And you concentrate inside this meditation globe with other people in that religious movement and try to find some element of transcendence. And the history of Pondicherry and Oroville, it goes back to the freedom struggle in India. But what I always found so fascinating was that it was this international community of people from France and Germany and the United States and India, all sort of living together and really making a go of it. I think I was around 24 years old when I was there. And eventually, after staying about a month, you know, sort of shadowing my sister, I bought a Royal Enfield motorcycle, a 350cc Royal Enfield Bullet, which is like the coolest motorcycle in the world, in my opinion. It is like they're terribly maintained. They fall apart, but they just sound so cool. And I was about to go on an adventure. I took that motorcycle across India, across the Aravalli Mountains, and then north, heading up to Mumbai. But before I got to Mumbai, I took a stopover in this town called Pune. I was alone, you know, my sister wasn't with me. And the reason I wanted to go to Pune is because there was this other religious group there by a very well-known, some people would call him a cult leader. Some people would call him a guru, a spiritual path breaker. His name is Osho, also Rajneesh or Bhagwan. Bhagwan means God in Sanskrit. And Osho is known for being sort of one of those ostentatious gurus, sort of above and beyond. He's your prototypical guru. And to get into his ashram, to walk into this, you know, Pune's a chaotic sort of Indian megalopolis. It's not a town. It's huge. And to get in, and you can see the trees from the walls. You know, there's walls that go around the compound. You can see the trees inside. You can see that it's lush and verdant inside. And when you go by it, you realize you just want to go in. But to get in the front door of the Osho ashram, you need to take a blood test. Yeah, that's right. You have to take a blood test, and you need to show a passport that you're from a foreign country. Luckily, I was an American and I have blood. And so I gave the blood test. And what they're testing for is the HIV virus. They wanted to be sure that no one who entered into the compound would have HIV. And then you also had to buy robes. There were white robes for some days and there were red robes for other days. And you had to purchase these robes if you wanted to walk around the inside of the compound. And, you know, there was some sort of admission fee. I don't remember what it was, but, you know, I was a budding, like I had ambitions to become a journalist and I thought I would write some article. Maybe the New Yorker would pick me up for a story. That's every journalist's dream, to write for the New Yorker. And I was like, I'm going to write a New Yorker piece about this Osho movement because it's so, so strange. And, you know, when you signed up, there was the option to get like this lesson pack where you could like take spiritual lessons in Osho's philosophy. And I signed up for a few of them. And there were also these lectures at night where, you know, Osho is dead. Osho died, you know, I think in the 80s. But they still screen on a giant projector underneath, you know, a geodesic dome, as I recall. And you'll sit and watch his lectures. And at the end of the lectures, they did this thing called kriyas, where you started essentially speaking in tongues. And everyone would just after he talked about how love is universal and that we should have push our sexual boundaries and reconceive what economics mean, and a lot of lessons that have, they're sort of Hindu spiritual bent to them, but twisted for the Western audience. Well, after all of that, everyone starts breaking out and speaking in tongues, waving their arms about. And I was looking at this crowd of foreigners in robes. Some of them are in like skimpy robes. And I start laughing too. I just start cackling that I am in this group of people, and everyone's wigging out, and all of a sudden I'm wigging out too. And, you know, after that, I was like, I don't know if I can really stay here all that much longer. I don't know if this is really my scene. And I'd heard from, you know, one of the practitioners there, someone and I think they were in a big red robe. Maybe I want to remember that she was like a beautiful Indian woman. But she told me that you have to go there that Thursday, because that Thursday there was going to be this sexual union that everyone was going to participate in. And my 24-year-old self was like, oh my God, they're talking about having an orgy. And I didn't know what to think about that. You know, like just like 10 feet away from here, there was this like room full of Mercedes-Benzes and Bentleys that Osho used to collect. And then there was going to be an orgy. And the whole thing, I mean, it just was a little off-putting. And I really thought, well, maybe I should stick around just to see what would happen. But in the end, my 24-year-old self maybe wasn't ready to go to the cultic orgy. And I got back on my motorcycle and I headed north. I went through Bombay and I headed north and I got stuck in the middle of the riots that were going through Gujarat at the time. But that's another story. The reason I'm bringing up Osho is that he's known to be one of the most flamboyant cult leaders in the United States of America, India, and the world. Because in the 80s, he founded this compound in the state of Oregon called Rajneeshapuram, and it grew huge. Thousands of people would go to listen to Osho's lectures, and the community got so controversial that he poisoned the local school board in order to rig an election in his favor. And that story was included in a documentary called Wild Wild Country, which I think is worth watching. Wild Wild Country, I think it's on Netflix, and it's about Osho and Rajneeshapuram and how he eventually thought that he was being poisoned by the CIA. And it was really my first exposure to seeing a cult up close. And I was thinking about this yesterday because, well, earlier this week, a new Netflix series came out called How to Become a Cult Leader, which I thought was a really good idea for a TV show. Like, what are the components that make a religious movement like take off, like to really just explode into the world? And they had some really interesting insights into cultishness. But I will point out that in both this documentary series, you know, which is narrated by Peter Dinklage, and also in Wild Wild Country, what is often missing is a real description of, well, I mean, you can't really put it any other way. The benefits of being in a cult. Like, when I was sitting in Osho's compound in 2002, the thing about his speeches were that they were captivating. They felt original. They felt new. They felt revolutionary. And even me, just sort of a passerby on a motorcycle, a tourist, a spiritual tourist, even I felt the pull into that. And oftentimes when we look at these organizations that we call cults, we think about them and we think about the followers as lost souls who are broken and who are almost foolish. But the thing about cult leaders, well, is that they are often captivating. And also, at least in the beginning, well, they're quite beneficial. They actually give something back to the person who is engaged with them. And it's really, really difficult to truly untangle where the good stuff ends and the bad stuff begins. So my thought for this particular episode is to give you my own recipe for what it actually takes to start a cult. And, you know, definitely also check out, you know, Peter Dinklage's amazing performance. But I do think that maybe in the way it was packaged, maybe they missed, you know, just a few things here and there. The first thing I want to point out is that if you're going to lead a group of people on your revolutionary new movement with insights into the fundamental nature of reality, you're gonna have to be pretty darn charismatic, right? You're gonna have to be someone who stands out as different, as original, and you need to, at least in the presence of an individual, when you're looking at them, they need to feel like they're the only person in the world. Cult leaders have to be talented. They have to be great orators to some degree. And I think that something that goes along with that is tendencies for narcissism, tendencies to think that you are special, to see you as the main character in the play of the universe in a way that is more than the average person's perspective, which, you know, we all sort of think about the world to some degree from that perspective. But at the end of the day, you have to really see yourself as better than everyone else. And in my experience covering cult leaders, I mean, there are certainly cynical leaders, right? There's certainly leaders out there, and I'm thinking, you know, maybe L. Ron Hubbard in Scientology, who started out as a science fiction writer who wrote really pulp, B-grade science fiction books. And then I think there's a quote in Lawrence Wright's book about the founding of Scientology, where L. Ron Hubbard actually says, you know, you can make a lot of money starting a religion. And then he started a religion that reads like a sci-fi book. He's sort of like on the cynical side of this, where he really, I mean, it seems like he was in it for the money. But on the other side, I think that most of these leaders really, really believe in the message that they have. They really have some sort of insight that is, at the very least, convincing to other people. But usually, they believe it too. At least in the beginning, there is this sincere feeling of belief that people can also feel themselves, that people want to grab onto themselves. And the theory that they posit has to be a worldview that explains absolutely everything in that realm in which they're covering. So, you know, there are certainly like religious cults out there, but there's also cults that focus around the wellness movement and financial cults and you know, various cults of personality. But, you know, the cult defines a range of intellectual property that it has controls over. And then it does something that sociologists call reifying, that their one insight explains absolutely everything about this one subject. So let's say we're talking about a health cult, that they might say that hormesis, or the stress that you put on your body, defines every single working system in the human body. And once you understand hormesis, you understand all of endocrinology, you understand heart attacks, you understand aging, you know, whatever it is. Or maybe they're pushing vitamin D or you know, sunlight. Like, they have to have this idea that's contrary to the mainstream, and their insight controls everything. Financial cults have some idea about success and money. You know, usually, like these days, it's something like the law of attraction. If you manifest the idea of money, you will get more money. It's the power of positive thinking. That's big. Or maybe it's that, you know, the blockchain will fix everything, and all of a sudden you're putting all of your money into Sam Bankman-Fried's Ponzi scheme. And religious cults, which are really my specialty, although everything that I look at sort of overlaps with these different organizations, religious cults explain consciousness and reality at large. They have one fundamental insight that no matter how you try to attack it from the outside, the logic of their philosophy makes it impervious to external scrutiny. Now, if you've been here for a little while, you know that I've written this book called The Enlightenment Trap. And in it, I looked at a Buddhist group, you know, this white lama from Arizona. His name was Michael Roach. He goes to India and discovers that he's enlightened and comes back and starts teaching Tibetan Buddhism. It's a great yarn. But I wanted to read you a passage of it to explain to you exactly how a concept is reified, how it becomes this one concept that is the master concept, one concept to rule them all. Now, to give you some context for this passage, Michael Roach is teaching at his Buddhist meditation center in New York called the Three Jewels, and he's going to lecture on the nature of emptiness to a crowded room full of followers. And this is, you know, the passage that I write about that scene in The Enlightenment Trap. And he's just done this sort of like flourish where he brings out from inside of his robes a ballpoint pen and shows it to the audience, just an ordinary ballpoint pen. And then he says, "This is all you need to understand emptiness." He said as he began the routine he'd practice at the monastery in Howell and perfected in lectures around the city before the official opening of the Three Jewels. "There is no pen here," he began provocatively. "There is a stick. It is purple, and it has a rounded shape. But what you're looking at now is not a pen. What you are seeing is pen." Half the audience smiled knowingly. The faces in the other half, well, they were blank. Roach clarified with a question. "To you, this is a pen, but what would it be to a dog?" he asked with a cocked eyebrow. "A dog can't write. It doesn't care about pens. For the dog, it is a chew toy." As the thing in his hand transformed from a pen into a chew toy in their minds, more people smiled. "For you, it is a pen. For the dog, it is a toy. But how can it be both?" "The idea for pen does not come from its own side. That knowledge must come from somewhere else. Well, it's coming from you." This concept of emptiness lies at the foundation of much of Tibetan Buddhism. Roach explained that the pen was empty of any intrinsic value or meaning. The knowledge of what a pen is begins in the primordial soup of the mind. What followed was a philosophical discourse on the nature of reality. Plato, Aristotle, and countless scribes, scholars, and mystics through the ages have wrestled with the problem. Tibetans have chewed on it for a millennia. Descartes reasoned that the common denominator of human experiences was thought, and that since thought was irrefutably real, then the mind that thought the thought had to be real too. Therefore, the world must also be real. For his part, Plato believed that all objects are mere shadows of an elementary ideal type. All trees were imperfect copies of an ideal tree, and we recognize all trees through their treeness. The same holds true for dogs and their dogness, or even cups and their cupness. For Plato, these ideal forms were not imaginary objects, but real ones that floated around in the ethereal, empirical realm that existed beyond the direct perception of humans. Roach built his version of Tibetan Buddhism on Plato's conception of reality, and then took it one step further. Perhaps there is no real world at all. There is no way to know if what we sense actually exists. Sensing in itself is problematic. Every feeling, taste, touch, and emotion has to first break through the barrier of our skin, blood, and neurons. The flesh sac filter touches everything, and on a profound level, who is to say that the mind itself isn't simply inventing the idea of a body in the first place? Everything that we think we know, from the smallest atom and subquark to the planets and solar systems that make up the heavens, and even the brain matter that processes information, might just be a hologram of some even more profound reality. After all, what do we really know about the world outside of our own minds? Once that thought sank in, Roach offered up another idea. Perhaps if you change your own mind, the world will change along with it. Roach gesticulated with the purple tube of ink and plastic in his hand and thrust it into the air. When you can understand the difference between a pen and pen, you can transform yourself completely. You could be an angel. It's as simple as that. You know, and from here, the Enlightenment trap, you know, really gets racing, because Michael Roach didn't just have an idea about pens. He saw everyone he ever met as some sort of divine manifestation, trying to give him an imprint and change the way he acted in the world at large, because they were all here for him, because he was an unabashed narcissist. Because cult leaders, well, they have to be narcissists. And his philosophy is intensely narcissistic, because everyone had to believe two things. One, that they were the center of the universe. And, contradictorily, that Roach was enlightened. Perfect. Once you have a hermetically sealed philosophy like that, well, your group can sort of get off to the races. Because once people really believe what you're saying and they can see the world through your eyes, the only thing you have to do next, well, it's collect followers. You just need to grab the attention of enough devoted people, or at least potentially devoted people, and then those people will get their own people, and all of a sudden this social network, this real world social network, will create your loyal following. Now, for Michael Roach, you know, and for many cult leaders, one thing you have to do is to stand out and be flashy. This is part of the, you know, the charisma that I talked about earlier, right? But you need to be someone who has, you know, honestly, a lot of times, crazy outfits. For Michael Roach, it was the robes of a Tibetan Gelugpa Lama, the yellow hat, the red robes. He looked a little like the Dalai Lama. If you saw him on the street in New York, your head would turn. For other people, Osho, he had his white robes and his red robes. You know, you think about, you know, David Koresh had his Jesus outfits. Manson, you know, of the Manson murder fame. You know, he actually carved symbols into the foreheads of himself and his followers. If you're the type of person to think that Wim Hof is a cult leader, well, look at that guy's outfits. He's in a caftan distributing health information. It helps to be flashy, for sure. And that flashiness actually works on a couple levels. Because if you dress obviously different from the people, you have your own uniform, you both create an in-group of other people in your uniform who you feel comfortable around, and people on the outside, well, they can sort of get allergic to you, right? If you saw a group of people in, you know, flowers and tambourines and you know, loose flowing robes walking down the street at you, you would know, I mean, most likely, you would know that you're not one of them and that they had their own thing going on. Those uniforms serve to both create an internal feeling of connectedness and a sort of allergy to the outside world. It's a way to set yourself apart. You know, look at the Amish, right? They wear their 1850s outfits. It's the same thing. It's a way to keep control of somebody who enters in to the boundaries of the philosophy that you've already created. It's a signal to the outside world that you think differently. But even more important than the robes that I had to buy outside the ashram in Pune, there is this other thing which is super duper important. And I don't think any group can possibly not have it. And it's what anthropologists call habitus, which is an, you know, habitus, how would you describe it? It's like an act. It's a thing that you do externally that gives you a feeling on the inside that changes you. And one act of habitus might be praying. Right, you sit and you kneel. There's a physical posture that you feel. You fold your hands in front of you and you pray and you put your emotions into that prayer, and that creates a response, a physiological and emotional response. If you read my book, The Wedge, you could say it creates a wedge as well. And this habitus, you know, you can hear in that word, habit, that's the root of that word. It should be a regular thing. It should be a practice that you go back to repeatedly. And a lot of these groups create many different types of habituses, right? Sometimes they make you fill out ledgers where every single minute of your time is accounted for, and the accounting of that time is some way to get into heaven, this overworked habitus. It could also be like speaking in tongues from the Christian perspective, or the crazy stuff that I was doing, laughing hysterically in a group of berobed, beautiful people in Pune. It could also be an ice bath or breath work, or, you know, honestly, it could be anything that is physical. It could be an elaborate snapping routine, if you like. It could be a gang symbol with your fingers, you know, tied into like elaborate knots. Any of these things that you assign them a symbolic value, and it draws you into that sealed ideology that we had before. Now, just to make up a habitus here, let's say that bending over and touching your toes was the movement that your cult leader wanted to create. And you feel that sort of stretch in the back of your hamstrings. And some of that was a holy sensation. Well, if you did that at the same time you were thinking that somehow that might save the world, and you could create a theology that did that, you would over time make, you know, to physically form intellectual bonds in your followers, that becomes this reinforcing mechanism, both socially and physiologically, in the minds of the people who are following you. And this flows really nicely into another very important part of building your cult. You need to know who is going to be a cult follower, like the good follower, not somebody who's just like sort of a casual person who listens to your lectures sometimes and gets some interest. Now, obviously at first you do want an open message that anyone can be interested in. You know, like universal love is a good one, but also being healthier is a good one. You want as broad a message is in, if you want to talk in the terms of marketing, this is a click funnel. You need a very broad end of that click funnel to get people in before you find those true followers, those diamonds that will sift into the bottom of your funnel. At first, your open teachings go to everyone, and the people that are interested in this are oftentimes, they feel like they're missing something in their life. Maybe they are sick, maybe they're broke, maybe they're just lonely. But these are seekers looking for an answer to a problem that you promise you can solve. And in most cases, you know, in most of the groups that I've looked at, there's also this practice called love bombing. And love bombing is, you know, it's really just about in every religious movement to some degree, is that at first you feel welcoming to that new person. You never been to like a religious service and everyone's hugging each other and slapping each other's backs, and you know, it can be like overly intimate. And to some degree, I'm sort of allergic to that sort of interaction. But for someone with a different personality or a different set of needs, it can be something that's been missing their whole life. You know, they have trouble with their parents or their spouse or whatever. And then there's this group that just, well, they love you. And they even might have like this idealistic idea that love will conquer the world and will actually be the thing that sets the world right. Oftentimes, the habitus that is formed, is sort of a meditation, let's say, the idea is that habitus on its own can have huge consequences for the planet. You know, oftentimes the idea is that if we got a million people to meditate all on one focused problem, like, you know, climate change or, you know, world peace or something, and if just enough people in the world meditate, you would fundamentally change the fabric of the universe and that war would go away. This is a super common idea in prayer and in religious movements and, well, in cults. And the cool thing is, with this habitus, well, you're going to notice some changes real quickly. And I talked about this in my episode on the law of speedy gains, which was episode 6 in this podcast. But, you know, when you first try to, like, you know, touch your toes, you know, maybe you're not that flexible and you're not gonna be able to do it. But I promise you, the more you try to touch your toes, you're gonna get more flexible and there's going to be this immediate or at least very quick improvement. And soon you'll be able to touch your toes. This is the law of speedy gains. You try something new, you try a meditation practice, a sauna, an ice bath, whatever, breath work, you're gonna notice changes quick. And then over time, it takes more and more effort to get additional gains. You know, once you've touched your toes, what are you supposed to do after that? Touch, you know, 5 inches below the floor? Well, that's going to take more work. And sometimes, and here's where those groups really upsell you, is they tell you, well, you know, you've had the open teachings, you've had the love bombing, but now you have to get ready for lesson 2. And lesson 2 is going to be a lot more expensive, either financially, but more realistically, in time and effort than what you got with level 1. You're going to have to work hard. You're going to have to do more habitus. Now, before we go further, and I got a lot more to say, this is the time in the program where I take a small break and remind you that we've 30 minutes in right now and you haven't heard an ad if you're listening to this, you know, the audio version on Spotify or Apple. But if you're the sort of person who really likes these sorts of shows, well, what I ask you to do is to get exclusive content, you know, early drafts of what I'm working on by signing up over at Patreon. And there's a link down below for how to be part of my community and, you know, even chat with me on Discord and, you know, put input into shows as they come up. I would love you to join in. It's not that expensive. And you really help this sort of independent journalism, you know, sing. But if you're not the type to want to pay money on a subscription. I get it. There's a lot of shows that I don't subscribe to. I mean, there's a lot that I do, but, you know, I get it. But there's another thing that I'd ask you to do, which is to log on to Apple. It has to be Apple because, you know, for some reason, Spotify doesn't allow this to happen. And put a review in Apple, and it should be 5 stars. And the reason it should be 5 stars is, well, one, you know, hopefully you like this show. But it helps people find it. And if it's 5 stars, I will read your review here at this segment in my podcast. And I'm really sad to say that in the last week, I haven't gotten any 5-star reviews on my podcast. So I could leave this blank, or I could read a 5-star review that just came in on my book, The Enlightenment Trap, just a few days ago. And so I will read that in lieu of a 5-star review on this show. This is by a woman named Jacqueline L. on my book, The Enlightenment Trap. And she says, this is the same review that I put on Goodreads. And she titled it, The War of the Egos. I thought this book was excellent. For whatever reason, I was haunted by these events and kept coming back to them, trying to understand the psychology behind the madness. So when I saw the title, I just jumped on the book. And the title and then the analysis is exactly that. The description of inflated ego gone completely mad and delusional, leading to tragedy. In a funny sort of way, it's a classic Shakespeare in the sense of Hamarita. I don't know what Hamarita is. Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And no one warned that the emperor isn't wearing any clothes, as though the onlookers, media, and participants colluded in this delusional train as it became finally uncontrollable and derailed. It really makes you tremble with the hindsight knowledge that sooner or later a tragedy is going to unfold. And Scott Carney has rooted out, as far as it is possible, the whys and wherefores, and you just can't put the book down. For me, it is investigative journalism at its best, because although we will never really know the absolute truth of what was going on in the minds of the protagonists, Scott Carney comes as close as it is humanly possible to showing us the descent into delusional ego madness, not to mention hell hath no fury like a woman scorned, and the terrible, terrible awareness of having to live with the consequences of the folly of ego. I am certainly going to read more of Scott Carney's writings. Personally, I feel he has proved the qualitative depth of his investigation and has made the closest we will ever come to understand the duality of the human heart and the machinations of the human ego. The road to hell is paved with good intentions. And Scott Carney has got the message across with page-turning precision. Holy crap, that was a great review. I can't believe it. I love reading stuff like that. And if you start clicking those buttons, you know, give me a 5-star if you're on Spotify, or go over to Apple and write something equally as awesome, I will read your thing too. And it doesn't need to be like this gushing thing. You could just do a 5-star review and talk about the best way to solve a Rubik's Cube, and I will read that too. So get to it. Without further ado, I'm going back into my show. So I was just talking about love bombing and how followers, are increasingly putting more work into, their habitus creation and, you know, the idealism of saving the world. Well, there's this book. It's called The Guru Papers by Diana Alstead and Joel Kramer. And it's one of these books that I come back to all the time when I'm thinking about the development of alternative religious movements. And they have an entire theory into the psychology of cult leaders. And they point out that some of the most diehard cult leaders out there, well, they come to the movement because of terrible tragedies and vulnerability in their own life. And I'm going to read a little passage, a short passage from that book to discuss. People are especially vulnerable to charismatic leaders during times of crisis or major life change. Most often, those who enter into this kind of authoritarian group are having problems bringing meaning, human connection, and good feelings into their lives, all of which become instantly available upon joining. What they also gain is a sense of power, usually greater than any they had previously had. Although seemingly relinquishing their power, they actually trade what little personal power they had to piggyback on the guru's power. Occasionally, people who did have power elsewhere forsake their old lives to become disciples, largely because their previous successes were unsatisfying. Interestingly, these people usually end up in the guru's inner circle. The higher up one is in the organization, the more power and even livelihoods are hooked into the guru. This makes it very difficult not to accept, rationalize, or deny any incongruous, greedy, or corrupt behavior on the part of the guru or the organization as a whole. This is the sunk cost fallacy of these groups. Now, remember how I said you start changing your clothes and people might look at you funny and that brings you into the group? Well, once they have you, even just that little bit, you've donned the robes and maybe you've started giving some money, the more you invest into that organization, the harder it is going to be to leave because your personality, your self-worth is all tied up into what that organization has given you. And then when your cult leader starts to, have sex with your wife, which happens frequently, or just has sex scandals or starts taking money and spending it in crazy ways or gets into a drug habit or whatever other crazy thing that they might do, you find ways to explain that away. You explain how that's okay, how that teaching is something called, well, maybe it's crazy wisdom. And I did a podcast called How the Monk Who Fucked Everything, which is still one of my favorite podcasts. And check that one out if you want to see where crazy wisdom really goes off the rails. But there's this concept in Sanskrit, and there's a Christian corollary, but I know the Sanskrit better. It's called upaya. And it means to demand truth, but that you can lie for the right reasons. So all of these groups openly say that being truthful is a central tenet to everything. We have to have honesty if you're going to see reality. And almost all organizations demand truth. But they also have this sort of like escape hatch that if the truth isn't convenient, you are allowed to lie for the higher purpose of whatever cyclical, hermetically sealed ideology that lies at the very top of your organization. The idea that meditation will save the world or your guru is really, really wonderful, whatever it is. Well, that is... those are the stakes, and therefore you can lie if you feel like it's going to be ultimately Machiavelli-y useful for the benefit of the planet. And when this idea gets there, well, cults just do whatever the hell they want. You know, there Satya Sai Baba, who's a famous guru in India, you know, big hair, big sort of like afro hair. He was known to never allow magicians into his performances because he would do these miracles where he would, put his hands out over the hands of his followers and shake his hands and these ashes would fall into the hands of his followers. And it was like this proof that this guy can do miracles. But also, if you were a magician, you were not allowed to come anywhere near that guy. So there's a thought there. Like, why is that? Maybe those ashes aren't really that miraculous. You know, and then as Alsted noted, that you have this core group and there's this idea of an inner circle. You know, and the inner circle is always the people who are closest to that guru character. And oftentimes it's the richest. Or the prettiest. Or the most talented in some way. Like, those people end up being ever closer to the very hardened core of your religious group. But there's still, you know, when you are a guru, what you want to do is select people for loyalty, right? You want to put them through, well, essentially like a purity test, right? You want to actually give them some of that cognitive dissonance. You know, when you're having sex with your followers or their wives or, you know, whatever it is that you're doing, that actually helps you cement a core of followers who will never question you as you go forward. And if you're really savvy, you then have those followers, these sergeants at arms, start doing your dirty work for you, right? When you have like a negative thing to put out, you know, it wasn't Osho who gave the negative messages, it was Sheila, his number two. You know, you keep the positive face, you insulate it as much as possible to the public so that once somebody gets in, you know, past the cell wall of the external side of your cult and they're in, only after they've sunk some costs in can they start to see the contradictions. And this is the click funnel, the marketing hype that provides the psychological basis for these mass movements, where it can go all the way, and in very extreme cases, to mass suicide and even murder. And it all started just because of these sunk costs. And when I say mass suicide or murder, you know, the Mansons, that's how it started with them. Or with, you know, the People's Church with Jim Jones, where 700 people committed suicide because they couldn't see another way out of the cult. And of course, from there, it's not very hard to make money off of these people, you know, little sunk costs. And what's tithing 10% of your income to the leader? What's tithing all of your income to the leader? Once they're in for a penny, you're in for a pound. The last thing I want to leave you with is a formula that I whipped up when I was writing The Enlightenment Trap originally. And I wanted to know, what's the difference between a cult and a religion? You know, Christianity, it's been around for a long time. Buddhism, been around for a long time. Whereas Mormonism is much younger. Certainly the People's Church was very, very recent. What is the difference between a cult and religion? Well, it comes down to a very simple formula. Cult plus time equals religion. All of those religious movements, it really doesn't matter which one, if they stick around long enough, you can have the strangest belief system in the world suddenly sound pretty darn normal over time. I don't really see that much difference between Buddhism, Christianity, and Scientology, or Mormonism, Jainism, Sikhism. You know, those are newer movements. And these older movements, like all it is any sort of belief system that is reified. You know, heaven and hell are in a constant war, and we are the frontline soldiers, and prayer is our method of attack. That basic philosophy is bananas from some degree. And yet it forms the core of several Abrahamic religions. And brings us to where we are today. It is now a religion. Whereas a cult might be like your TV is talking to you, and your TV is God, and cryptocurrency is going to save the world. Well, they sound a little strange now, but they're going to sound a lot less strange if millions of people follow it for hundreds of years. So that is my podcast on how to start a cult. These is my basic ideas, and I'd love you to leave a comment down below, your thoughts, maybe what you think I should do next. Maybe you have an idea for another podcast, or even better, an interview guest. You know, I run a poll on Spotify oftentimes after these shows where I ask, do you like these monologues, or do you like interview shows, like the interview I had last week with Josiah Hesse, where we talked about his escape from an evangelical church and how he became part of the ex-evangelical movement. And it's great. There's some tongue talking in that too. Do you like those back and forths with guests, or do you prefer these monologues? Well, answer that question for me. There will be a poll down there in the description. And I'd really appreciate you just weighing in, because I want to know as I curate more content for you in the future. From Poke Bear LLC in Denver, Colorado, this was Scott Carney Investigates.